Good afternoon, Chuck Morse here, Monday through every Thursday morning, 10 to 11 a.m. here at WMFO 91.5 a.m. Tufts University, Medford, Boston. You're welcome to join this program, which is live. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. Come on down. You're welcome to join the show. The program also live streams, and it goes up on my Pod-O-Matic and iTunes, as well as live streaming on YouTube, so you could actually see the show, hear the show. You know, I mean, I'm kind of old school, but I'm starting to get into all of these newfangled technologies thanks to my teenage daughter, who understands these things, like most people her age do. In fact, I think that the upcoming generation, to them, this is like any language. It's part of what you do. So I appreciate that. I will say out front, a conservative, a libertarian, in the midst of an institution, that being Tufts University, which I think it's fair to say is one of the most liberal in America, and also one of the great incubators of America's future leaders. I thought it would be interesting to ask my listeners what you think in these days, in this new age and the era of Donald Trump. Have people gotten acclimated to the administration? What do you make of it? How are you feeling? I know that there was yesterday a women's march, a women not going to work. I mean, I heard it said liberal women not going to work, but putting that aside, what is that all about? What does that mean to you if you're a woman? What does it mean to you if you're a man who supports women's rights, which I do? And what was the message in that? From my perspective, I think that I'm not sure there was much of a message other than to hate Donald Trump, which I think is something that's waning over time, or it's becoming a little bit more obscure. Women have equal rights in this country for the most part. It's not perfect, but women are at all levels of our society, economically, politically, in every other way. Some women tend to choose to be more traditional, others don't. You know, it's kind of equal pay for equal work. Well, I think that's something that we all support, but it's a more complex issue than it appears on the surface, in that oftentimes women, because they are women and therefore many of them choose to get pregnant and have children, they leave the workforce for periods of time, you know, to have the baby, to have time at home with the baby. In some cases, they choose a more traditional route, which is to stay home with the baby and bring up their children. So the result is that while they're home with their baby, the man is working and is advancing as such. They're on a fast track, or at least a faster track. And so, yeah, they make more. You know, I mean, it's kind of, I suppose, if the shoe were in the other foot, and in many cases it now is, where the father stays home and brings up the children and the wife works, then she's on a faster track and she earns more. So I think that plays a role in that. As far as abortion goes, abortion is legal in this country. I honestly don't think there's any threat to that. I think that most people understand, including most conservatives, that abortion has to be legal, even if we find it to be abhorrent, and in most cases, you know, we hope that it doesn't happen and it's a tragedy. Ultimately, the government cannot force a woman to have a baby. I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, what are we going to do, put women in jail? So I think that most people, including most people who are pro-life like me, understand that abortion has to be legal. It should be regulated, in my opinion, by the states, because I support the concept of subsidiarity, and I think that social issues like that ought to be reflective of the values of the people in a given state. With the government, the federal government having some role in it, like, for example, if a state, which is extremely unlikely, decide to ban abortion, then that state, there could be a federal statute which would require the state to help a woman who wants an abortion to have one in across a state line by transporting her to that state, to the other state, and paying for all of the activities. I think that would probably be a fair statute. But if the state ultimately wants to do that, which I doubt if any of them would, then that's their right. You know, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that abortion has to be legal. So I guess my question is, how are you adjusting to the new this revolutionary time? I think that the it's not so much Donald Trump himself, but what he represents is something that is quite contrary to the traditional left-leaning leftist, if you will, Tufts University profile. You know, I mean, he stands for an economy that actually is a reflection of what is happening in the economy today, but it runs contrary to what the left believes in. And that is a move toward subsidiarity, independence, smaller businesses. Thanks to the internet, people can be employed anywhere they want. I mean, you know, there are so many businesses that are emerging, and this is going to continue in the future, where people don't necessarily need to go to a big factory and punch in a time clock. You know, those days are over. I mean, the height of that was actually in the 1930s. Today, people can run a business right out of their home. They could work any time of the day or night. You have the Uberization of the economy, and I'm part of that because I drive Uber, where people will buy a little unit of something. They'll buy an event rather than owning a car, rather than, you know, you buy a ride. You hire someone to take you from point A to point B. And I think that there is that movement in our economy toward the purchase of events, if you will, rather than, you know, items. And that one of the side products of that is that there is less mass production. You know, there's more local production. There's a trend more toward localism in general, rather than the big national and even international regulations and control that is the hallmark of leftism. You have more local control. You have more laissez-faire, more free market, where local people regulate or deregulate, as it were, the way they conduct business, the way they conduct trade, the way that the transactions they engage in. You know, this is a trend toward buying local products. You know, something that's not well known but is an interesting part of history is that in the 1930s, as part of this sort of socialization, this massive internationalism, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, was set up by Franklin Roosevelt under the guise of an emergency the Securities Administration to not only regulate all securities, which is good, but to force all municipalities and many businesses, or at least, you know, make it easier for them and more difficult not to trade through Wall Street, right? Wall Street became the most powerful bursar in the country, in New York, whereas commodities would be in Chicago. Well, I mean, there's a move afoot, and it used to be the case that you would have local exchanges. The Boston, well, why does it have to go to Wall Street? Why not have it go to a Boston Stock Exchange or even a Worcester Stock Exchange, where the municipality will keep the money locally rather than send it to New York, rather than send it to, you know, big investment houses which put it into international and national investments? It would be invested locally into local businesses and into the local economy to develop a local and even a regional or even a state economy. You know, these are things that can lead to more sovereignty, more individuality, more creativity. You know, there is a trend economically now where we are once again putting our trust into people as opposed to government. we are beginning to reassert our rights, in our natural right, to self-government, which is what this country is all about. This is the great American experiment. Can we govern ourselves as opposed to having this great overlord, this divine right of kings, which is something that was rejected by our founding generation, and which the left totally is. It's the embodiment of leftism, except instead of dressing up in ermine and pearls and calling themselves a hereditary king, they look like Hillary Clinton or John Kerry or George Soros, you know, these kind of like, you know, big executives who feel that they have some kind of an enlightened right, if you will, to control our lives, to control all aspects of our lives. Well, the Trump administration, at least in terms of what it represents, now what it is another question. That's a whole different story. But what it represents, what it has unleashed, is this idea of a move toward more self-government. Steve Bannon at the CPAC convention described it very accurately when he said that the goal of the Trump administration is to begin the deconstruction of the administrative state. In other words, they're actually getting rid of these bureaucracies and these people, unelected mostly, who have been given the power, or who have assumed the power to make laws over us. Anyway, I'm going to do a brief experiment here. I'm always learning the board here. I'm going to try to do a PSA. So let's just see if this works.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Okay, I did it. I actually did it, PSA. Hooray, hooray, hooray. 855-915-9636 is the number. Now let's see if I can take a phone call. That'll be a big hurdle. 855-915-9636. Right here at WMFO 91.5, Medford, Somerville, Boston, Tufts University. So I'm talking about the age of Trump, what it represents, and what it represents to you, the Tufts University student, the Tufts University faculty, more broadly, the Tufts University culture, which has been left of center, to put it mildly, and why these new progressive ideas, and when I say progressive, I mean really genuinely progressive, not leftist progressive, which are regressive, I would argue, why these new ideas are important to understand. I would hope ideas that we could get behind, but at least understand them, so you can understand the forces that are wafting through our culture today as you prepare and as you go through your college years and prepare to enter then into your professional phase of your life. I mean, it would make sense and it would be appropriate to get into what it's about. So you have this, you know, on the economic level with the Trump administration, you have this move toward, as Steve Bannon so accurately stated, the deconstruction of the administrative state. Now, in that same speech, and the text of that speech is available on the CPAC website, it's pretty amazing. He says that not a day is going to go by without a fight, because the Trump administration is facing the forces of the establishment, and is doing so with great courage. I mean, as they wade forth, you know, this is not just the left, but the establishment Republicans, the internationalists, the establishment Democrats, certainly, the media, academia like Tufts University, and much of the sort of the high ground of our culture, as well as, I would argue, the top 1% wealthiest Americans and wealthiest institutions, whether they be foundations, unions, corporations, inheritances, all these great combines of wealth, they're all invested in this leftist transfer of power from the elected government representing the people, and as such, a self-governing nation, to this administrative state that Steve Bannon is talking about. You know, this idea that governing authority, and I think the trend really picked up in the early part of the 20th century, but there's always been, you know, it's always been here, this regressive idea that governing authority should be transferred from elected officials operating under a limited grant of power from the Constitution and under God to these bureaucracies, whether they be public government bureaucracies given sovereign powers, perhaps the most recent one being the Consumer Protection Agency set up by Elizabeth Warren, that's been given sovereign power to not just regulate businesses, but to literally go into businesses without a warrant and confiscate their property. I mean, this goes way back. This isn't new. These agencies are appointed and they're spun into an entity that can actually make laws. They don't call them laws. They call them, quote, guidelines or directives or whatever. But they're making laws, and that those laws can affect our freedoms. And generally speaking, they are socialistic. Even if they're not, they shouldn't be making those laws, because the Constitution says that only Congress shall make law, all law, on a federal level, and that the laws not specifically delineated to Congress by the Constitution, Article 9 and Article 10 of the Bill of Rights, those reside with the states and with the citizen. And the citizen, of course, gains their sovereignty and their ability towards self-determination and a certain degree of control over their destiny from God. So, that's a major change that the Trump administration represents. Another is democracy, localism, state sovereignty, subsidiarity. I've talked about that. The third is national sovereignty. Now, national sovereignty is a big one. That's where the United States resides on the world stage. Up until the Trump administration, and Donald Trump is one of the few political leaders to really give this at least some expression, even in his own inarticulate style, nevertheless. The trend has been toward merging the United States into a world system, a new world order. Now, if you combine that with the transfer of powers to unelected entities, whether they be, you know, bureaucracies or agencies or even individuals, you have what you might describe as an informal world government, an unofficial world government. Not a world government in the official sense that has a flag and a stamp and a logo and a particular ruler, but an unofficial world government that leaves in place the sovereign nations. At least they think they're sovereign, but they've become tied in through a web of obligations and debt and other things and international laws to this world order that is not controlled by elected officials, but that is controlled by these informal bureaucracies and figures. And it is something that it certainly exists on the national level. It's what, as I said, Steve Bannon calls the administrative state. It even exists on the state level, by the way, but that's another subject. But on an international level, it takes on the role of the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and a whole long list, literally hundreds at this point, of what's called NGOs, non-governmental organizations, all of which are assuming these same bureaucratic powers that our domestic and even state entities are assuming, all of which is not only unconstitutional, because as I said, the Constitution of the United States grants powers only to Congress, and that's the end of the Constitution, but it's also very undemocratic. Do we want to have these agencies making decisions about our lives? You know, do we want to have this conference? I'll give you one example, and I don't remember the specific names of things here. I wasn't expecting to talk about this today, but there was an international conference on the family. I think it was in the 1970s, and it came up with a manifesto, if you will, of what to do in terms of ruling over families, mothers and fathers and children. And concurrently, it had in it rules by which a child could sue their parents, a parent could be taken, they could be removed from the home. And it was all in language that was very vague. You know, I mean, it's one thing if a child is physically abusing a parent, a parent is physically abusing a child, that's a crime. And they can be taken away. But we're talking about an international entity that's not elected, that puts in this vague sort of Orwellian authoritarian language, this language of totalitarianism, by which some kind of an international agency can decide whether or not you bring up your child, right? Now, this, of course, has been the long dream of the international socialists. You know, I mean, the collective raising of children, the removal of children from the home at a young age, where they could be brought up to become, you know, I guess you might call it human resources as opposed to children. You know, they could be conditioned, right? People think I'm exaggerating. Look into this. The point I'm making here is that this international order is being interrupted by Trump and what he represents. And not just Trump either, but also in England, you had the Brexit, and you have other national movements in other countries around the world, some of which are good and some of which are not so good. But the point of the matter is that they all generally stand for, at least officially, the reassertion of the sovereign rights of the nation state. And the nation state is a progressive institution. It's something that has evolved over centuries, if not millennia, going back to Roman times and even before. The nation state is, it's democratic. It's a means by which people who organize the nation state, based upon a lot of things, it could be based on religion, it could be based on culture, it could be based on geography, that these nation states have emerged, that they have been able to, by creating a government, they have been able to assume sovereign control over their own lives and over their own destinies, how things are done in their own nation states, economically, spiritually, politically. And let's just see here. Let me just download this one too, upload it. Okay. I'm doing a little experiment here with YouTube. So you have basically with Donald Trump and with these other movements, the emergence of a national state. Now that, of course, is completely anathema to the left. It was utterly anathema to people like Barack Obama or even the Bushes or even Reagan to an extent, who wanted regional government, who wanted a North American entity of government. They want to have a world government, and in some cases quite openly, which is an undemocratic idea. So Donald Trump, by simply saying, I am going to put America's interest first, he is doing something that's quite radical and quite revolutionary, at least it shouldn't be seen that way by people like myself. It seems normal. Of course we're going to put our nation first. That's who we are. We're Americans. We want to put our nation first in the same way that if I was Zimbabwean, I'd want to put Zimbabwe first. There's nothing chauvinistic about that. We all should put our nation first. But for the left-wing establishment, it is a very radical idea because they want to subsume American nationalism and all nationalism into a world order. They believe nationalism, or they claim to believe that nationalism is a bad thing, is something that's outdated, that we have to get with the times and move toward one world government. In fact, Stephen Hawking just said, there's a report about this in the Drudge Report, that if we don't, we have to move toward world government, or else we, in order to cope with the development of cyber technologies. I would think cyber technologies should have the exact opposite effect, frankly. It should move toward more individual rights, because if a person can be connected to the internet and start a business or write a tweet or send out an article, then that person has more individual sovereignty. Not, this is a move away from these overarching international entities. So, you know, we have with Donald Trump this simple idea of making America great, making America first, putting all Americans, and when he says all Americans, he means all Americans, their interests first over those of people who are not Americans. Does that make sense? Of course it does. You know, I mean, he wants to put our economic interests first by making deals with foreign entities and domestic so that they can create businesses and jobs. And that means getting rid of, in many cases, onerous regulation. It means lowering taxes. It means simplifying taxes. It means getting rid of things like Obamacare, which is a drag on business, and thus allowing more people to go to work. What could be a greater social good than work? That is the greatest social service ever. It means having America's position in the world such that we are defending our own interests. Now, that very well might mean standing up to North Korea or Iran. But if we do it, then we're not going to do it like Barack Obama did it with his fight against ISIS, which was to do nothing, or to basically drag his feet for 4 years at the cost of how many, I don't know, possibly upwards of $1 trillion, and ISIS is still metastasizing. I think that if Donald Trump does it, he's going to do it. Get the job done. Go in and kick their you-know-what. Defeat them, I would think. I would hope. We shall see. Now, as far as... and then, of course, the fourth spoke in the wheel with regard to the Trump revolution is a reemergence of faith. Now, Donald J. Trump, personally, I don't know if he's a believer in God. I don't know if he's Christian. I don't know where he stands. Although I do think he's become more religious since running for president due to his experiences of being in touch with thousands of people. But whether he personally is religious or not is not relevant. The important thing is that his movement is leading to a reemergence of faith, of belief that there is a supernatural God, a creator of the universe, a giver of law, who exists outside of human manipulation, that there is such thing as objective truth. There is such thing as reason. That's what makes us different from the animal kingdom. We can perceive right and wrong. That's what reason is. That we are created in the image of God, but we are not God, which is to say that we, you know, we're imperfect. So therefore, this is why we have a system by which you and I, as imperfect beings on this earth for just a short period of time, we can look to a higher power for immutable truth to guide us and to reward us, at least spiritually, not necessarily materially, for that guidance, and that we may experience punishment if we try to overthrow that guidance and deny it and seek to supplant it with human control, which is what leftism is. You know, the left wants to overthrow God in heaven. Karl Marx wrote about this extensively, and replace God with themselves. So I would argue that the Trump movement is a reemergence of belief in that which is true. And that which is true is that there is a God. Anyways, let me play a PSA and then we'll come back after these messages. I'm just so thrilled that I can do this.
This is the sound of E. coli splashing around in raw hamburger juice on your cutting board. And it looks like Mom just put the tomatoes and onions on there too. Don't let E. coli mosh with your food. An estimated 3,000 Americans die from a foodborne illness each year. So always separate raw meat from vegetables on two cutting boards. Keep your family safe at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
The federal government alone spends $4.5 billion a year locking up people for drug offenses. It costs almost $28,000 a year just to incarcerate one prisoner. Compare that to the average annual tuition at a four-year public college, which is $5,591, and you realize that the drug war is blurring our nation's priorities. Taxpayers' money would be much better spent educating people instead of punishing them. But thanks to ever-increasing mandatory minimum drug sentences, an entire class of young people are being filtered into new supermax prisons while the resulting budget crunch forces the rest of us to go to old, dilapidated schools. The more money we dump into prisons, the less we have to invest in college campuses. Visit www.schoolsnotprisons.com to find out how you can get involved in the war against the war on drugs.
Thank you very much. Which reminds me, I mean, I suppose one way we can reduce the cost of prisons in this country is to get rid of the illegal aliens who are being held in those prisons. I mean, they're costing us, I don't know, $100,000 a piece a year to give them three square meals. I'm sure that they do not want to have to go back to the countries of their origin, because there they'll probably face a much more severe situation of prison. Many of them are violent and have been involved in violent crimes. That I suppose, would naturally bring us to the question of immigration and the authority of the federal government to regulate those who come into this country. That is an assumed authority that goes all the way back to the days of John Adams. I mean, this is and his Alien Act. This is he did that in response to a threatened invasion by the French Jacobins, who were landing on our shores at that time and trying to foment an American Revolution. This is something that not only has been the purview of the executive with congressional support and approval, but it's more transcendent than that. It runs its basic common sense. Any sane sovereign nation, according historically and today, according to international law and customs, has the right, indeed has the moral imperative, to decide who enters the national home and who doesn't. That's just a basic. That's one of the basic building blocks for sovereignty. It's not only a progressive idea, but it is a natural idea. It is natural in the same way that you, as an individual, has the right to decide who enters your place of domicile, your home, your apartment, wherever you live, your dorm room. You have the right, whether it be in the law, which it is, or whether it be just an obvious aspect of your natural existence, you have the right to decide who enters your place. You know, it's just like you have a right to associate with whoever you want, free association. You have the right to free speech and free press, although those things have some regulation, because you can't, you know, you cannot engage in libel and slander or incitement. But you have a right, because that interferes with other people's rights. But your right to decide who comes into your home or not, that's even more fundamental in a way, because that does not interfere with anyone else's right, since no one else has the right to enter your home. If someone is in your home and you want them to leave the home, they have to leave. And if they don't leave, they can get arrested. It's called breaking and entering. It's called trespassing. You know, I mean, they could call the police, have them removed. Well, that same principle applies to the nation state. The nation state has an inherent right to decide who enters the national home, and they don't have to explain themselves. There doesn't have to be a reason for it. It's just there. You know, it doesn't, there's nothing. I hear all this talk about, you know, President Trump having a Muslim ban, which it is not a Muslim ban. But even if it were a Muslim ban, it's his right as the chief executive of this government to decide to who is entering the country and who isn't for any reason. It's just that simple. Now, you may not like it because you may love the idea of Muslims coming into the country. That's fine. That's your right, too. But our elected government, headed by our elected president, has the right to determine those policies. There's nothing unconstitutional about it. And I know there was a Supreme Court, a district court, the District Court of Appeals of the Western District decided that it was unconstitutional to have a Muslim ban. And in fact, the state of Hawaii just filed a case against the new ban, saying it's a Muslim ban. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that this government can't ban any group or any person. No one has the right to enter this country. Now, I'm not here to say I believe we should have a Muslim ban. I don't. But I respect the rule of law, and I respect the right of this nation to say that we're not going to welcome these people, or we are going to welcome those people. It's just that simple. There's no such thing as discrimination. You do discriminate. Just like you as an individual discriminates in terms of who comes into your home. You don't want to have a freeloader. You decide who comes in your home. So there's nothing unconstitutional about a government saying we're going to ban Muslims. Now, it might not be moral and it might not be ethical, and I don't think it's appropriate, but it's not a constitutional question. Now, what about the question of banning Muslims? Let's go right to that because you know, it's controversial, and this is, you know, I'm in the middle of Tufts University here, and I want to, you know, maybe push the envelope a little bit. I do think that if someone wants to come to this country who happens to be Muslim, who is willing to be self-sufficient, who brings resources with them, who brings skills with them. They're a doctor. They're, you know, they've got a science, you know, they're scientists. You know, they have, they're entrepreneurs. They've got something they want to add to our society. And they're willing to take a loyalty oath to this country, which is to say that they're willing to promise to, you know, put their hand on the Bible and say, you know, or they could just put their hand in the air and say, I will uphold the laws of the U.S. Constitution, and they mean it. And if they don't do it, then they can be, you know, there could be questions about being deported. Then I have no problem with them coming in. In fact, I welcome them. They could be American citizens. But I don't think we can tiptoe around the bush here when we talk about the nature of Islam and whether or not it's in the broad sense compatible with our constitutional limited government democratic approach. I would suggest that it's problematic. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but there are some big problems with that compatibility. Now people, you know, they said this about the Jews and they said this about the Catholics. Yeah, they did, and they were wrong. Jews and Catholics do not adhere to any laws that would be incompatible to American law, right? And the difference is that Islamic law, as derived from the Quran and the Hadith, do contradict directly American laws, right? I mean, there's nothing, you know, un-American about wearing headgear, or, you know, for women to not have physical contact when they're having their periods, and or dietary laws or anything like that. Those exist in ultra-Orthodox Judaism. Catholics have certain laws, you know, and yeah, there even are political things like opposition to abortion, opposition to gay marriage, whatever it is. Those things are fine. Those are advocacies. But the difference with that and Islam is that Islamic law, Sharia law, from what I understand, and I will tell you, I'm not an expert, but I've done more than a cursory examination of it, particularly since 9/11. It not only imposes itself on its own adherents, particularly women, in that it's very oppressive to them. They don't have rights. A woman can have a husband, under Islamic law, a husband can beat his wife, right? A husband can divorce his wife just by declaring, I divorce you three times. The woman has no property rights. The woman is property herself. Women are almost like children. They're like subservient in Sharia. And when I say subservient, I'm not talking about, you know, in Christian and Jewish law, women are not allowed to participate in certain aspects of the theological side of things, like they can't be priests, or in Judaism, in Orthodox Judaism, they can't read the Torah. Those are theological, those are voluntary. I mean, a person doesn't have to participate. They can join a Reform synagogue, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm just saying it's not, you know, those are mandatory. Those are just there as an option. In Islam, it's not an option. Women are subjected, unless they want to break away from the faith, which I think is fine, obviously, or they want to sort of turn their back on their actual religion. The doctrine itself is very problematic with regard to the way it views women. It's also true of the way it views gay people. It views homosexuality. A homosexual could be thrown off the roof and is being thrown off roofs in ISIS-controlled areas, right? I mean, it's extremely problematic with regard to someone who drops out of Islam. They could be put to death, according to Islamic law, and they are put to death. I mean, these are just facts in Islamic law. These are in Sharia, you know, in the Hadith. And these are very violent things. It has all these death penalties. Now, the Torah has death penalties. You know, you could be put to death, frankly, for homosexuality in the Torah. Yes, you can. Or even like dishonoring your mother and father. But the difference is that Judaism and Christianity have developed a system of jurisprudence which regulates these things to a high degree, to the point where it doesn't happen. You know, they stand in Judaism as an example of what not to do and of unholy behavior, but the literal carrying out of the death sentence is more symbolic, and it always has been more symbolic. I don't think in Judaism they ever were putting the people to death for dishonoring their mother and father, specifically. The problem in Islam is that they do put people to death for these things. They do cut off hands. You know, this is happening, has happened all along, because they don't have a developed system of jurisprudence. They don't have an organized, in Judaism we have the Talmud. In Christianity, they have, at least in Catholicism, they have canon law with a pope and a college of cardinals and subsidiary bishops who are able to rule on these things. I think most Christian churches have a version of that. Islam doesn't have that. So as a result, you have this authoritarian control by Sharia over the most intricate and intimate aspect of the lives of its adherents. And it has an advocacy of things that clearly do run against our Constitution. We don't allow honor killing in this country. You can't kill your sister or your daughter because she goes out on a date with a guy. You can't do that. But in Sharia law, not only can you do it, but it's being done in this country by Muslims. The New York Times won't report this for reasons that are interesting. So when there's a killing in Greater New York, and those have increased over the past decades, where a young girl is murdered by her father or her brother, they don't report the fact that the people were Muslims. They just say, oh, it was a murder. It's terrible. So you have these sorts of laws in Sharia which are not compatible to our American constitutional system, our way of life, our approach toward rights of women, rights of gay people, rights of individuals. You don't have that in Sharia law. So you have people who don't relate to those things in the same way we do. The other aspect of Sharia law that we cannot tiptoe around is jihad. Now, I realize that there is a westernized, sort of sanitized view of jihad, that it's the inner search for identity and faith and improvement in your own self. Great. That's a more Western view of faith. I mean, that's fine. But the fact is that that's really not what jihad is or has been historically. Jihad is two things. It's bloody war against the infidel until they submit, and the word Islam means submit. Or it's what's called civilizational jihad, which is that in this way, Islam operates a lot like communism did. They worm their way into a society through subversion and work their way up the rat line until they're in positions of power. And then they implement it stealthily to the point where people don't even know what's happening. Now, in the case of Islam, I think that it's not unreasonable to suggest that civilizational jihad is being carried out through immigration. I mean, why is it that Muslims are not immigrating to other Muslim countries? Why are they immigrating to Europe and the United States? Why is it that they want to come here? Is there a civilizational jihad component to that? I think it's fair to say that in most cases, no, there's not. In most cases, Muslims, and I don't blame them, they want to get the hell out of those miserable countries where there are no rights, there's no property, there's no safety, there's no advancement. These are putrid, backward societies, which is another question about what Islam, the fruits of Islam. But putting that aside, they want to get out. They want to make something of their lives. They want to be American. And I applaud that. But there is still the aspect of civilizational jihad that runs as a thread underneath it, and that they can still be radicalized once they're here by jihadic advocates. And that has happened. You know, I mean, it's happened even here in Boston. We have cases where people have fled the city to join ISIS. We have, what was her name? She was actually a student at, of all places, at Brandeis, a traditional Jewish college. She's now, you know, she was captured in Afghanistan. They call her Miss Taliban, right? You know, so you have cases where young Muslims in the United States, entirely Americanized, Islamic, which is fine, but yet, you know, very much of secular orientation, that they become radicalized. They embrace jihad. So, jihad ultimately seeks world conquest, the submission of the entire planet to the scimitar, one world government, literally. Maybe that's why jihad and why Islam tends to resonate with the far left, who also sees one world government, what they call revolution. So these are factors that I think need to be looked at when Americans ask our government, who should be immigrating into this country. Do we want to have millions of Muslims? I mean, I'm happy that we have some. I think it does add to diversity. That's a good thing. But do we want to have millions of people who might adhere to Sharia law and jihad, who don't recognize the rights of women, you know, who want to behead homosexuals, right? I mean, do we want to have that, who have different courts, you know, they don't recognize American court jurisprudence, they want their own, who want to turn America into a part of the caliphate? I'm sorry to be blunt here, but that is a part of the religion. That's documented. And that is a part of the religion that a lot of Muslims adhere to. You know, radical, ultra-religious Christians, they may be annoying, you know, with the proselytizing, but they're not trying to impose anything on anybody. You know, same thing with Jews. You know, they might want to impose their values on their own people, and even then they can't use force. It's not legal, and they don't really ultimately seek government force to do it. You know, they're not really authoritarian in the real sense. Only governments could be authoritarian. But that's different than the Islamic approach, which is to use the government. The government becomes a part of this system, and thus it is imposed not only on their own people, but on all people in that government. Because if you're not Islamic in those states, and this includes the six states on President Trump's list that by which immigration has been temporarily banned. If you're not Islamic, you have no rights. You literally, it's like the way we treated African Americans in Jim Crow before the Civil Rights Movement. We got over that to a large extent. We have a lot of work to do, but the point is that we're moving away from that kind of thing in this country, and we've made enormous strides to do that. Islam still imposes that, and they do it by law. They think this is a virtue. This is the command of their God and of their prophet. You know, they don't even, you know, I think that Jim Crow, even in the South, was understood to be a disgusting and really despicable institution. But they did it because it was part of their custom. I mean, this is, in Islam, it's viewed as virtuous. Now, there are moderate Muslim voices who are rejecting this. Thank God. We ought to amplify those voices. People like Dr. Zudi Jasser, whom I've interviewed. But I wonder how much inroads they're making in not just in this country, in the Islamic community, but around the world. I don't know. According to Ayan Hirsi Ali, the Somalian author, who grew up, who was raped, and who was treated like a lot of women are treated in the Islamic world, and who's now a professor and a very well-esteemed author, she says that they are not reforming. She says that she can no longer consider herself to be Muslim because of it. So, you know, these are open questions that need to be debated when we ask our government to do what it's constitutionally mandated to do and morally mandated to do, which is to set immigration policy, which is to decide who enters a national home and who doesn't. Anyway, you're welcome to join me in the final segment, 855-915-9636. Chuck Morse, Monday, every Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m. here at Tufts University, WMFO. I ought to mention that my books are available on Amazon or Amazon Kindle. I've written about 15 books, all published or self-published, that kind of cover the map in terms of the topics they I delve into. I'm also a columnist at Newsmax.com. My column usually comes out every Tuesday, Wednesday. In fact, I'm going to read right now. I got a minute. I'll read my latest column. This one hasn't been published yet. The working title, and they always change the title, the editors. They do a nice job over there, by the way. They put in a good picture, and it's very good. Al Franken, Joe McCarthy, Russia. This is my Newsmax column. Senator Al Franken, Democrat of Minnesota, while pushing the fake conspiracy theory that the Trump campaign was colluding with Russia, routinely asks Republican nominees if they had any Russian contacts. He asked Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions if he had contact with Russians on behalf of the Trump campaign. Sessions answered honestly when he said no. However, as is normal for any chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he had plenty of contact with the Russian ambassador in that capacity. If the Democrats are successful in pulling off their Russian hoax, then Franken and the Democrats might be able to make the case for perjury. They have not, however, made the case, as even Obama Director of Intelligence James Clapper admits that his investigation of these charges came up with no evidence. The tactic employed by Franken harkened back to the congressional hearings hosted by Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin, back in the 1950s when he asked government officials if they had contact with Russia, except for one difference. Joe McCarthy was right. Senators John F. Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, Lyndon B. Johnson, Democrat of Texas, Hubert H. Humphrey, Democrat of Minnesota, as well as others inside and outside of government, agreed with McCarthy's contention that many government employees, starting in the 1930s, had secretly colluded with Soviet Russia. Indeed, the declassified Venona intercepts and the opening of Russian archives in the 1990s proves, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that American officials did collide with communist Russia. Many of these same officials, among them FDR's Undersecretary of State Alger Hiss and Undersecretary of the Treasury Harry Dexter White, had put the interests of both Stalin and, I might add, Adolf Hitler over those of their own country in the first 2 years of World War II. It was during this period, August of 1939 to June of 1941, that the international left was essentially allied with Nazi Germany. After the war, the clear majority of Americans, including many prominent liberals, wanted this conspiracy investigated. The far left mocked Americans, accusing them of paranoia, of seeing a red under every bed. Now the shoe is on the other foot. Now the left sees a Russian under every bed. But, in a sense, the enemies of McCarthy back then are the same as the enemies of President Donald Trump today. They sought to destroy McCarthy for his audacity in defending American interests in the same way that they now seek to damage Trump's ability to do the same, to put Americans and American interests first. The American far left supported Stalin and Hitler back then because of a misguided and amoral belief in world order. Today, the left supports open borders for the same reasons. Both then and now, they seek to subsume the national interest and, I might point out, their own personal interest in exchange for some demented and artificial fantasy of an authoritarian international order of absolute equality. When Joe McCarthy took on those who had secretly supported Hitler and Stalin, he was standing up for the same principles back then that Donald Trump is standing up for today. So there's my column. That will appear, unless it's rejected, and most of my columns aren't, next Tuesday. Looks like we're reaching the end of the program. I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. This is Chuck Morse at WMFO. Have a good day, everybody.
And I shot off a rocket in the park.
Today, my new son and I failed to shoot off a rocket.
He knew exactly what to do.
It's not working. I had no clue what I was doing.
We set up the rocket. Hit ignition. And then?
And then nothing. Ha, 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 ha.
What?